This is Peggy Baker. I'm at the home of Rita Sequeira in Edmonton. And the date is October the 5th, 2018. And we're going to talk about her life in Athabasca and before Athabasca. So Rita Sequeira was born in India. And I'll let her tell you about her family and her growing up years in India, starting with whatever her earliest memories and her parents. Rita?
Hi. I was born in India in a town called Mangalore on July 21st, 1935. I'm one of four children born to Ligari D'Souza and Lily Jane D'Souza. I had an older sister named Gladys who passed away many years before I was born, so I haven't really seen her. So for all counts, I'm the oldest of three. My second sister is Margaret, and my younger sister is Sophie. My mother passed away when I was 4 years old, and my siblings were 2 and 10 months old. I was brought up basically by my mother's sister, Aunt Grace, till my father remarried when I was 15, and my sisters were 13 and 11. All my education was done in English. The medium of instruction was English, and I went to schools run by the Apostolic Carmelite sisters until I finished my grade 11. That's the secondary school. And then I did my BA, Bachelor of Arts, also at the university run by the Apostolic Carmelite sisters. After I finished my Bachelor of Arts, I did a course in social work. It was called, I got a diploma in social work. And this year was run by a lady who came from the United States by the name of Miss Yasis. And she offered courses in social work for 1 year. In 1957, I married Charles Sequeira. And then I moved to Telicherry, which is in a way in a different province. Because I left my hometown, Mangalore. I left this particular province. I went to a different province to accompany my husband. And we had three children. The oldest, Arun, was born in 61, the second, Prem, in 62, and the youngest one, Nimi, was born in 63.
Rita, what was your daily, what was your day like when you were growing up? And who else was in the household besides you and your sisters?
Okay. When I was going to school, the other people in the house were my father, and until my father remarried my aunt, my mother's sister who took care of us, and my mother's brother, uncle, Dennis, who lived with us as well. But after my father remarried, of course, my stepmom, Marceline, was with us. My day, my father was very particular about school. he was particular also about church. I was born and brought up a Catholic, so We went to daily mass. Dad was very particular about that. Then, of course, homework, school. I was quite active in school. I was the whole school pupil leader. It's something like the students' union president here. And that kept me busy. My father was also particular that we learn music in the house. So I learned to play the violin at the age of 6. And I played in the school orchestra in the school. I was a member of the school orchestra, which meant a lot of practice after school. So I kept busy with that. And that continued even after I started university. All 4 years of university, I was a member of the college orchestra as well. So that kept us busy. And also, I was, and my sisters were members of the community orchestra. And what did we call it? I think it was called the Amateur Music Society. So,
what did your father do to make a living?
Okay. My dad owned a coffee estate, and he also managed the estate for some European coffee estates. So they didn't live in Mangalore. He had to be away on the estates. Yeah. So we lived, as I said, mainly with my aunt Grace, and later on with my stepmom.
Do you remember any significant events in your early life? What do you remember as being dramatic or traumatic?
Traumatic, I think, when we were very, very close to my mother's sister, Aunt Grace. And when my dad remarried, it was very traumatic for the three of us when Aunt Grace had to leave. She did join the convent because that is something she wanted to do, I believe. But she stayed back because of my mother's death. So that was a very traumatic experience for all three of us. And it was also a traumatic experience when my uncle passed away. He was very close to us. He was a bachelor as well. So that was a sad event for me and for my sisters as well. And then when my second sister Margaret, she joined the convent when she was very young, 17 or 18. I wouldn't call it a traumatic experience. She wanted to join the convent, but she was the first one to leave the home. And that was, in a way, a sad event for me, yes.
So when you started your university education, were you at home?
We were at home, yes. Oh. The university was right in my hometown, mm-hmm. Very close to where we lived, so we didn't have to leave and go far away, as our kids had to do here in Canada, leave Athabasca, mm-hmm. and come to Edmonton. One after the other. No, we didn't have to do that.
Mm-hmm. And it was about then you met Charles?
Well, ours was an arranged marriage in a way, and that's how it was done in my community. I knew his family because his older brother married a relative of mine. And this is how it is done. We are not forced to marry somebody, but in an arranged marriage in my community, you look at a number of factors. You know, does a person come from a good family? Does the boy come from a good family? Does the girl come from a good family? is the boy educated? Is the girl educated, so to say? They look at things like that. The older folks look at things like that. The parents look at things like that. And when they are satisfied, they give the boy and the girl an opportunity to meet each other. So my sister-in-law, who was married to Charles's older brother, gave us an opportunity to meet. So Charles came to my house and we had a chance to meet. We had a chance to go out and talk at length to each other, where we discussed a number of things. And then Charles had to leave and go back to his province, which would take him maybe half a day to go. And then he would write to me, and we would correspond that way, got to know each other. And after having done that for a few months, we were engaged. And 6 months after we were engaged and got to know each other more, we were married on October the 14th, 1957.
That was a big ceremony and celebration.
It was a big ceremony and celebration. And in our community, it takes 4 days. The previous day of the marriage, the bride has a celebration in her house and the bridegroom in his house, where you're not supposed to see each other and so on. The last day you are single and the last day the bridegroom is single. Then on the day of the marriage, you have the nuptials and a big, big ceremony. I think we had about 2,000 people.
Oh,
yes, yes. And then the third day, the bride's folks invite the bridegroom's folks and a few close friends, and you have a gourmet dinner, so to say. And the purpose of this dinner is to get acquainted with the bridegroom's family and a few new friends on the bridegroom's side. And the following day, it's the opposite. The bridegroom invites the bride's folks, and you get acquainted with the bride's folks, and it's a gourmet meal, maybe about 300 people. And then finally, the bride goes to the bridegroom's house permanently. Yeah. And then we had a fifth day, because I had to go to where Charles worked in a different province. And those people there would not be satisfied until they entertained us with their own function. So by the fifth day, I think both Charles and I had had enough of celebrations here.
Knowing Charles, I'm curious to know what you talked about at that first date, or that first time that you went out.
Well, he told me he was nervous, he said, about marriage. And some of the things he said were, his worry was, am I going to look after my wife well? Am I going to make her happy? And those kinds of things, basically. Not that he didn't want marriage, he did. But his fears were, you know, is he going to make his wife happy? Is he going to look after her well? What about the children? Will he be able to look after them well? These were some of the fears and concerns that he had. Yeah.
So that was a chance to really have an intimate conversation.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So then, you were in, Charles was practicing law.
And yes. For the first 3 years, he practiced law. Yeah, we were in a place called Telicherry, and he was law. And he had a fairly good practice. You know, he was just building up. And then I really came to know the type of person he was. When you're just beginning law, I guess, people have to pay you because you have to make a living. But Peggy, let me tell you that lots of times, instead of people paying him, lots of times, not all the time, there were poor people coming to him because they liked him. They had confidence in him. And we ended up sometimes people sleeping at the house because they had nowhere to go. They came from a distance. And I think we ended up sometimes giving them dinner and so on. And I said, but if you keep on doing this, where does the money to come from? And he said, don't worry. But he picked up work because they knew he was, I'm getting emotional here.
Yes.
Because they knew.
Do you want to stop?
No, no, that's okay. Because they knew he was honest. That he cared. Yeah.
So then he was appointed?
Yeah. After 3 years, he was appointed a public prosecutor. Yeah, which was the other side, of course. Mm.
So and that would be salaried.
Yes, it was salaried. Yes, yes, yeah. He got the position and he worked at the position for 6 years. And then after 6 years, he applied for the job of a magistrate, that is, sitting on the bench, yeah. And he worked on that 3 years. Yes. And at that time, in a different place, oh. The last, in Kerala, in the same province, of course, it was at that stage, I think, we started to become a little bit restless. We wanted a change. And the feeling of going somewhere else, it was becoming stressful as well. Not that he shirked his work, he worked very hard. But, you know, we wanted to go somewhere else. So at that time, interestingly enough, we heard that Canada was looking for teachers because we met somebody, Charles met somebody. A friend who had a friend who was working in Boyle in the county of Athabasca, who said they're looking for teachers. And this friend said, I will get you an address from somebody who is working in the county of Athabasca. So he brought this address the following day, and this is what the address said. Larson, superintendent of schools, Athabasca, Alberta, Canada. So that was all. No box number, no nothing. So this is how it all started. And previously, even before the children were born, I have to go a step back here. Charles had wanted to go somewhere, and he got a job in a high court in Uganda. But his mother wept. And he said, do you have to go? when you have a job here, you have property here, and so on. And I said to him, I don't think so. I don't think we should. And we decided that we won't go. With his mother's tears. So we dropped the idea. Then, of course, we had these children and so on. And this time, when we decided to go, and we told her, what do you think, Mom? She said, I'm getting old. You have to look after your future. And if you get the chance, maybe you should go. So Charles wrote the letter and gave it to his head clerk, saying that, and the letter stated to the superintendent of schools, Larson, whose first name we didn't know, not even his initials, saying that both of us would like to teach, because Charles didn't know what his prospects in law were, and we didn't even expect a reply because we didn't know Mr. Larson, didn't know his first name, didn't know anything. But we thought, maybe, let's give it a try. And Charles told this his head clerk, you type it. Charles drafted the letter, of course, but typing was done by the head clerk, and he told him, you mail it yourself, you type it, I will sign it, and don't breathe a word to anybody. So he mailed it, and we didn't even expect a reply. In about 10 days' time, or a little over 10 days' time, we got a reply. And this is what it said, and I quote, should you or your wife wish to teach in the county of Athabasca, we would be delighted to have you. And this did it for us. From not even expecting a reply. But he said, Mr. Larson said, you'll have to send all your documents to the Department of Education. Yeah. And they have to give you a certificate to teach. But if they do, we'll give you a job.
So then you had to break the news to your friends, yes, and family, and
yes,
kids?
Yes. Then started... my family was okay. But his family could not see why, from law, he would even think of... switching to teaching. Nothing was certain. Because I was already teaching. I had taught. I guess I left a little gap there. In 63, I did my B.Ed. I took you up to 57 when I got married. I already had my B.A. and my diploma. And then in 63, I completed my B.Ed. at the same institution. And I taught for 3 years. So my family, yes, if I was going to teach in Canada, okay, they were reconciled to that, it was okay. And they understood that we were leaving and going far away. They could, but Charles's family could not. They didn't want us. They didn't want him switching from law to teaching. Yes, they realized teaching was a noble profession. There was no dispute there. But they did not like the switching from law to teaching, if that's what he was thinking of doing. Yeah.
So you sent all your documents in to Mr. The superintendent?
Yeah.
And waited for this reply. And then what?
Okay. We sent all our documents to the Department of Education, and I got my certificate to teach. Anyway, we were all excited, now the only thing left was for us to get our visa to come to Canada. So Charles had to get permission to leave. He was at this time a magistrate in a place called Palghat in Kerala. We told the children we are going to Canada. At this time, our oldest Arun was 7 and Prem was 5. And Nimi was 4. They got very excited, of course. We told them about snow, which they hadn't seen before. And I resigned my position at the school. I had taught for 3 years at this time. And we were all getting ready. In August, we set off to go to Delhi to try and get our visa. We stayed at the convent where my sister was for a few days and then moved on to a Barsati, what we would call here a bachelor suite, I guess, yeah. And I was given a position at the convent school, in the high school there to teach, which brought in a little bit of money and was very helpful. Anyway, we had to go to the visa office, and there they asked us a lot of questions about our education, our ability to speak English, and so on. And we qualified, and bingo, we got our visa. Now the excitement started. The children were looking forward to our leaving. And on the 28th of November 1966, we boarded Air France to come to Canada. Until then, I have to say we were very excited about leaving India and coming to Canada. But once we got onto the plane and sat in our seat and buckled up, then I think the nervousness and concern sank in. I looked at Charles and I looked at the kids and I said, what are we doing? Have we done the right thing? We are going to a foreign land, a foreign culture, so to say, right in the middle of winter. And later on when I spoke to Charles, he said the same thing. He felt the same. What are we doing? Are we doing the right thing? Because once we land in Canada, there's no turning back. Anyway, we sat there looking at the children who slept in a few minutes. And our first stop was in Tel Aviv, and our next stop, I think, was in Montreal. And that was the first time we saw the snow. And the music was playing, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. And that got us all excited. The children were very happy, but of course we couldn't touch the snow. And our next stop was in Edmonton. And everything was nice. We got to Canada, the land that we had adopted. And we stayed at, I think it was King Edward Hotel, where we had some very interesting experiences. The taxi driver couldn't open the trunk. He said he had to pour some alcohol, and we couldn't understand why he had to pour alcohol to open the trunk of a car. Just didn't make sense to us. Well, the next day, we got up, got ready to catch the bus, which left Edmonton at 9 o'clock. We caught the taxi, of course, to go to the bus depot. We were just a couple minutes late. Now what do we do? Charles said, well, we have come halfway across the world. Let's take the taxi and go to Athabasca. So we asked the taxi driver, can you drive us to Athabasca? And she had no clue where Athabasca was, because she was an immigrant herself from Germany. But she called her office and found out where Athabasca was. And she said, okay. As she was driving us, it was 40 below, and not a single car on the road, not a single bus, no human beings, no animals, no nothing, just snow and snow and snow. And I looked at Charles, and he looked at me, and we whispered, where is she taking us? She drove and drove and drove, and finally we saw this board which said, County, welcome to the county of Athabasca. And Charles said, this is it. Wherever it is, this is it. So she stopped the car, the kids jumped out of the car and touched the snow, and they were excited. Once we reached Athabasca, there was Mr. Larson and Mr. Richards, the chairman of the board, and a few board members who came there to welcome us. And we were very, very excited. And that was a warm welcome indeed. We were home in Athabasca.
You had to make some special purchases of winter clothing, I think, before you came, right?
Yes, yes. While we were in Delhi, we had some winter clothes custom made. We bought some material in Delhi and had some winter jackets made. Custom made for us, which was great. But what we couldn't buy is winter boots. Yeah, those we went the next day and bought at Schinkinger's. And I still remember Mrs. Parks, Nora Parks, that is, Reverend Parks, was the minister of the United Church. She said that the two boys, of course, Nimi, our youngest daughter, was not in school, but the boys were in school, and they did go in shorts, I think, because they didn't have pants for at least one day. They said they looked like little English boys, she said, with the jackets that they had. We had to go to Schinkinger's very quickly and buy them boots because we couldn't buy any while we were in India. But we had a warm, warm welcome from Mr. Larson and the members of the school board. Anyway, one thing that Charles and I will never, ever forget, after 1 week's stay in the Union Hotel, because the home that was kept for us had to be given to someone else for rent, because we came 1 week, we came at the end of November. That house had to be rented to someone else. So 1 week we stayed at the Union Hotel, and that was quite an experience for new immigrants, I suppose. It was a bit noisy, but that was our first experience with the Canadian hamburger, which we enjoyed quite a bit. Anyway, and then we got a small house right across from the brick school, but it was very, very cold. It was not adequately heated. But it was a home, nevertheless. One night, the temperature dipped to 60 below. And in the middle of the night, our second son, Prem, began to cry, and he woke us up. And we said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I'm cold. I can't sleep." Just then, we heard a knock at the door. I think it was middle of the night, technically. And we said, "Who could that be? Who could come at the middle of the night?" And when we opened the door, there were these ladies from the United Church who had come with blankets, fearing that we may be cold. And that was the type of generosity that was shown to us, and that was Athabasca, and that was the warmth and friendliness that was shown to us for the next 42 years, and that's why we continued to stay there. And Athabasca was our home for 42 years. And our children had their foundation in Athabasca. And they went to Athabasca schools where their educational foundation was laid. Okay, I taught for in the Athabasca school system, so did Charles, and I taught for 30 years.
I'm curious about your experience when you first entered the classrooms in, wasn't Landing Trail then, it was Athabasca Elementary School.
Yes.
And what did you find as being different and unusual from your classroom in India?
Well, the first year that I taught, I took over from a teacher who had gone on maternity leave, and this was a grade 2 class. And at that time, I wore a sari, and the first thing, one little kid came up to me, she touched my sari, and she said, "I like your dress." And this was so cute. It's a little bit difficult to compare, in a way, the grade 2s to the high school students that I had taught. Language was no problem because I had studied, as I'd said earlier, in the English language. The medium of instruction was English. But I found classes here were more flexible. I was brought up under the British system where everything was a little more rigid, I suppose, the curriculum and so on was a little more rigid. And I found here there was a little more flexibility built in. There was more scope for the first few years for discussion with the students. There was a little more creativity built into their work, which I enjoyed. There was a little more discussion and so on that was built into the curriculum, which I enjoyed very much. While in India, it was slightly more rigid, I would say. As far as the discipline was concerned, here again in India, the children are a little more, well, it depends on how you define a discipline, but they tend to listen more to the school authorities and so on than they were here in Canada. More akin to doing their homework and those kinds of things than they were here. Like in India, for example, in an English classroom, if you gave them a composition or an essay to write and you corrected that essay, the kids were expected to do all the corrections and then you hand it back to the students. And when I corrected their mistakes and gave them suggestions for doing it over again, the kids here would be surprised. "We have to do it again? You mean we have to correct all those mistakes and hand it back to you?" I said, "Yes. I've spent all this time last night correcting it. Yeah, that's what I expected you to do." But that wasn't what they wanted to do. Kind of thing. So, yeah, there were differences like that, you know. But otherwise, I think children are children, and it depends on how you deal with them. You know, I didn't find too much of a difference that way.
During your career at in Athabasca High School, you and Charles both were very involved in lots of activities, but most people will remember you and your debating.
Yes, I enjoyed being involved with debating. So was Charles. And I think that carried over into the classroom as well. I not only did debating as an extracurricular activity, but I also incorporated debating into my classes as well. In English 10, 20, 30, whatever course I taught, I did debating in those courses as well, simply because debating is researching, speaking, thinking, critical thinking, being able to think on your feet, speaking, and language arts and is nothing but incorporating all these skills. So it worked out really, really well.
And you had some spectacular results.
Yes, yes, yes. And it brought students together. It brought the community together. Because I remember in the tournaments, especially in the provincials, we needed 120 judges, we needed 40 chair people, and we needed people to serve, to cook, to drive, you name it. We needed hundreds of people from the community, and they came, they helped. And in a small town like Athabasca, nobody said no. That was the beauty, I think, of the town. Like just yesterday, my son Arun, he sent me an email. He said, "Mom, somebody else I met yesterday sent me an email saying they remember you and Dad because you were so involved in the community." Sometimes it's almost embarrassing when they say things like that, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. And Charles and I couldn't have enjoyed it if it didn't provide me with the chance to be involved with the community. And I think that is really, really important. I have to thank them because they gave me a chance to be involved. Yeah. I was involved with the Fringe, and I still remember whenever I picked up the phone and I phoned somebody, unless they absolutely couldn't come because of some of the commitments or they're not being there, they always, always said, "Sure, I'll be there. What do you want me to do?" And that was so exciting. And I appreciate them. I appreciate their help for my kids. I think my children's character was built because of this community. And that was wonderful. And if we could continue to stay there, we would have still stayed in Athabasca. Many people say, "What took you out to Athabasca? Why would anybody go there? Isn't it cold there? Wasn't it cold there?" I said, "Of course it was cold, but it was the warmth of the people that made all the difference." And that was wonderful.
What was the response of your family and friends in India when you told them about 60 below and so on?
Okay. Well, when we... Peggy's question was, what was the response of the people when we told them it was 60 below? Yes, they worried. They worried every time they wrote or we phoned them. They were worried about 60 below. And I remember the first, I think the second year, my sister came to visit Athabasca. She came for Christmas. And two things happened that year. Just she was in Athabasca for about 2 weeks, I think. And just about every day, she had an invitation, either for supper or for tea or for a visit or something. This is my sister Margaret, yeah. And our people were dropping in to visit her, or we took her around, or something happened. And number two, it was an exceptionally warm Christmas season. And she met so many people that year. And I told her, I said, Margaret, when you go back home, tell them, yes, they are warm. And yes, they have lots of friends. And once she went back home and she told them that people were very friendly, and though it is cold, if they are comfortable and they are warm, then they were satisfied. And my other sister has come several times, and they have seen how friendly people are, and you, in spite of the cold, you can be warm. They are satisfied and they are very happy.
So as your teaching career, both of you, developed, then you both became involved in professional organizations, and then some of the political organizations of the political side of schools and education.
Well, both of us after retirement were on the school board. Charles was also the chairman of the school board. He was on the school board for just one term. He chose to be only for one term, but he was also involved with the Multicultural Association and many other organizations as well at the provincial level. I was on the school board for three terms, and while I was teaching, I was also involved with the communications of the ATA and several other, the Political Action Committee of the ATA. But what I enjoyed most, I think, was being with the fringe, being with the live arts, because that involved the community, and I did like working with the Athabasca community, because I got to know them so much through the organizations with which I was involved. And it was a very sad day for both Charles and me when we had to leave in 2008 to go to Edmonton, because his health made it necessary for us to leave because of specialized medical care. One other thing that I really, really enjoyed was I was what they call a university facilitator, where I supervised students, B.Ed. students, who have to do some student teaching. And I had to supervise them while they were doing their student teaching. And interestingly enough, Mr. Francis, who later became the superintendent of schools, was my first student teacher. That was over 20 years ago. And that was, I enjoyed doing that. And I've had many other students who are my student teachers and who are now employed with Edwin Parr High School. And I was also, as a school board member, a liaison between the university and the Alberta School Boards Association, working on a committee how to improve the quality of student teachers and what could be done at the university level to improve teaching practices and so on. Yeah. So it's been a very interesting life for me, both as a teacher and as a school board member and as a member of the Athabasca community.